Chapter 11. Yesterday morning I went to the doctor. Was taken by a guardian, one of those with red armbands who are in charge of such things. We rode in a red car, him in the front, me in the back. No twin went with me. On these occasions, I'm solitaire. I'm taken to the doctor's once a month for tests. Urine, hormones, cancer smear, blood test. The same as before, except that now it's obligatory. The doctor's office is in a modern office building. We ride up in the elevator silently, the guardian facing me. In the black mirror wall of the elevator, I can see the back of his head. At the office itself, I go in. He waits, outside in the hall, with the other guardians, on one of the chairs placed there for that purpose. Inside the waiting room, there are other women, three of them, in red. This doctor is a specialist. Covertly, we regard each other. Sizing up each other's bellies. Is anyone lucky? The nurse records our names and the numbers from our passes on the CompuDoc to see if we are who we are supposed to be. He's 6 feet tall, about 40, a diagonal scar across his cheek. He sits typing, his hands too big for the keyboard, still wearing his pistol in the shoulder holster. When I'm called, I go through the doorway into the inner room. It's white. Featureless, like the outer one, except for a folding screen, red cloth stretched on a frame, a gold eye painted on it, with a snake-twined sword upright beneath it, like a sort of handle. The snakes and the sword are bits of broken symbolism left over from the time before. After I've filled the small bottle left ready for me in a little washroom, I take off my clothes behind the screen and leave them folded on the chair. When I'm naked, I lie down on the examining table, on the sheet of chilly, crackling, disposable paper. I pull the second sheet, the cloth one, up over my body. At neck level, there's another sheet, suspended from the ceiling. It intersects me so that the doctor will never see my face. He deals with a torso only. When I'm arranged, I reach my hand out, fumble for the small lever at the right side of the table, pull it back. Somewhere else a bell rings, unheard by me. After a minute, the door opens. Footsteps come in. There is breathing. He isn't supposed to speak to me except when it's absolutely necessary. But this doctor is talkative. "How are we getting along?" he says, some tick of speech from the other time. The sheet is lifted from my skin. A draft pimples me. A cold finger, rubber-clad and jellied, slides into me. I am poked and prodded. The finger retreats, enters otherwise, withdraws. "Nothing wrong with you," the doctor says, as if to himself. "Any pain, honey?" He calls me honey. "No," I say. My breasts are fingered in their turn, a search for ripeness, rot. The breathing comes nearer. I smell old smoke, aftershave, tobacco, dust on hair. Then the voice, very soft, close to my head. That's him, bulging the sheet. "I could help you," he says, whispers. "What?" I say. "Shh," he says. "I could help you. I've helped others." "Help me?" I say, my voice as low as his. "How? Does he know something? Has he seen Luke? Has he found? Can he bring back? How do you think?" he says, still barely breathing it. "Is that his hand sliding up my leg? He's taken off the glove. The door's locked. No one will come in. They'll never know it isn't his." He lifts the sheet. The lower part of his face is covered by the white gauze mask, regulation. Two brown eyes, a nose, a head with brown hair on it. His hand is between my legs. "Most of those old guys can't make it anymore," he says. "Or they're sterile." I almost gasp. He said a forbidden word. Sterile. There is no such thing as a sterile man anymore, not officially. There are only women who are fruitful and women who are barren. That's the law. "Lots of women do it," he goes on. "You want a baby, don't you?" "Yes," I say. "It's true, and I don't ask why because I know. Give me children or else I die." There's more than one meaning to it. You're soft, he says. It's time. Today or tomorrow would do it. Why waste it? It'd only take a minute, honey. What he called his wife once, maybe still does, but really it's a generic term. We are all honey. I hesitate. He's offering himself to me, his services, at some risk to himself. I hate to see what they put you through, he murmurs. It's genuine. Genuine sympathy, and yet he's enjoying this. Sympathy and all. His eyes are moist with compassion. His hand is moving on me, nervously and with impatience. It's too dangerous, I say. No, I can't. The penalty is death. But they have to catch you in the act, with two witnesses. What are the odds? Is the room bugged? Who's waiting just outside the door? His hand stops. Think about it, he says. I've seen your chart. You don't have a lot of time left, but it's your life. Thank you, I say. I must leave the impression that I'm not offended, that I'm open to suggestion. He takes his hand away, lazily, almost, lingeringly. This is not the last word as far as he's concerned. He could fake the tests, report me for cancer, for infertility, have me shipped off to the colonies with the unwomen. None of this has been said, but the knowledge of his power hangs nevertheless in the air as he pats my thigh, withdraws himself behind the hanging sheet. Next month, he says. I put on my clothes again, behind the screen. My hands are shaking. Why am I frightened? I've crossed no boundaries. I've given no trust, taken no risk. All is safe. It's the choice that terrifies me. A way out. A salvation. Chapter 12. The bathroom is beside the bedroom. It's papered in small blue flowers, forget-me-nots, with curtains to match. There's a blue bath mat, a blue fake fur cover on the toilet seat. All this bathroom lacks from the time before is a doll whose skirt conceals the extra roll of toilet paper. Except that the mirror over the sink has been taken out and replaced by an oblong of tin, and the door has no lock, and there are no razors, of course. There were incidents in bathrooms at first. There were cuttings, drownings, before they got all the bugs ironed out. Cora sits on a chair outside in the hall to see that no one else goes in. In a bathroom and a bathtub, you are vulnerable, said Aunt Lydia. She didn't say to what. The bath is a requirement, but it's also a luxury. Merely to lift off the heavy white wings in the veil, merely to feel my own hair again with my hands is a luxury. My hair is long now, untrimmed. Hair must be long but covered. Aunt Lydia said, St. Paul said it's either that or a close shave. She laughed, that held back neighing of hers, as if she'd told a joke. Cora has run the bath. It steams like a bowl of soup. I take off the rest of the clothes, the overdress, the white shift and petticoat, the red stockings, the loose cotton pantaloons. Pantyhose gives you crotch rot, Moira used to say. Aunt Lydia would never have used an expression like crotch rot. Unhygienic was hers. She wanted everything to be very hygienic. My nakedness is strange to me already. My body seems outdated. Did I really wear bathing suits at the beach? I did, without thought, among men, without caring that my legs, my arms, my thighs, and back were on display, could be seen. Shameful. Immodest. I avoid looking down at my body, not so much because it's shameful or immodest, but because I don't want to see it. I don't want to look at something that determines me so completely. I step into the water. Lie down, let it hold me. The water is soft as hands. I close my eyes, and she's there with me suddenly, without warning. It must be the smell of the soap. I put my face against the soft hair at the back of her neck and breathe her in. Baby powder and child's washed flesh and shampoo, with an undertone, the faint scent of urine. This is the age she is when I'm in the bath. She comes back to me at different ages. This is how I know she's not really a ghost. If she were a ghost, she would be the same age always. One day, when she was 11 months old, just before she began to walk, a woman stole her out of a supermarket cart. It was a Saturday, which was when Luke and I did the week's shopping because both of us had jobs. She was sitting in the little baby seats they had then, in supermarket carts, with holes for the legs. She was happy enough, and I turned my back, the cat food section, I think it was. Luke was over at the side of the store, out of sight, at the meat counter. He liked to choose what kind of meat we were going to eat during the week. He said men needed more meat than women did, and that it wasn't a superstition, and he wasn't being a jerk. Studies had been done. There are some differences, he said. He was fond of saying that, as if I was trying to prove there weren't. But mostly he said it when my mother was there. He liked to tease her. I heard her start to cry. I turned around and she was disappearing down the aisle in the arms of a woman I'd never seen before. I screamed and the woman was stopped. She must have been about 35. She was crying and saying it was her baby. The Lord had given it to her. He'd sent her a sign. I felt sorry for her. The store manager apologized and they held her until the police came. She's just crazy, Luke said. I thought it was an isolated incident at the time. She fades. I can't keep her here with me. She's gone now. Maybe I do think of her as a ghost. The ghost of a dead girl. A little girl who died when she was 5. I remember the pictures of us I once had. Me holding her. Standard poses, mother and baby, locked in a frame for safety. Behind my closed eyes, I can see myself as I am now, sitting beside an open drawer or a trunk in the cellar where the baby clothes are folded away, a lock of hair cut when she was 2 in an envelope, white blonde. It got darker later. I don't have those things anymore, the clothes and hair. I wonder what happened to all our things. Looted, dumped out, carried away, confiscated. I've learned to do without a lot of things. If you have a lot of things, said Aunt Lydia, you get too attached to this material world and you forget about spiritual values. You must cultivate poverty of spirit. Blessed are the meek. She didn't go on to say anything about inheriting the earth. I lie, lapped by the water, beside an open drawer that does not exist, and think about a girl who did not die when she was 5, who still does exist, I hope, though not for me. Do I exist for her? Am I a picture somewhere, in the dark at the back of her mind? They must have told her I was dead. That's what they would think of doing. They would say it would be easier for her to adjust. 8, she must be now. I filled in the time I lost. I know how much there's been. They were right. It's easier to think of her as dead. I don't have to have hope then or make a wasted effort. Why bash your head, said Aunt Lydia, against a wall? Sometimes she had a graphic way of putting things. I ain't got all day, says Cora's voice outside the door. It's true, she hasn't. She hasn't got all of anything. I must not deprive her of her time. I soap myself, use the scrub brush and the piece of pumice for sanding off dead skin. Such Puritan aids are supplied. I wish to be totally clean, germless, without bacteria, like the surface of the moon. I will not be able to wash myself this evening, not afterwards, not for a day. It interferes, they say, and why take chances? I cannot avoid seeing, now, the small tattoo on my ankle. 4 digits in an eye, a passport in reverse. It's supposed to guarantee that I will never be able to fade finally into another landscape. I am too important, too scarce for that. I am a national resource. I pull the plug, dry myself, put on my red terry cloth robe. I leave today's dress here, where Cora will pick it up to be washed. Back in the room, I dress again. The white headdress isn't necessary for the evening because I won't be going out. Everyone in this house knows what my face looks like. The red veil goes on, though, covering my damp hair, my head, which has not been shaved. Where did I see that film about the women kneeling in the town square, hands holding them, their hair falling in clumps? What have they done? It must have been a long time ago because I can't remember. Cora brings my supper, covered, on a tray. She knocks at the door before entering. I like her for that. It means she thinks I have some of what we used to call privacy left. Thank you, I say, taking the tray from her, and she actually smiles at me, but she turns away without answering. When we're alone together, she's shy of me. I put the tray on the small white-painted table and draw the chair up to it. I take the cover off the tray. The thigh of a chicken, overcooked. It's better than bloody, which is the other way she does it. Rita has ways of making her resentments felt. A baked potato, green beans, salad, canned pears for dessert. It's good enough food, though bland. Healthy food. You have to get your vitamins and minerals, said Aunt Lydia coyly. You must be a worthy vessel. No coffee or tea, though, no alcohol. Studies have been done. There's a paper napkin, as in cafeterias. I think of the others, those without. This is the heartland here. I'm leading a pampered life. May the Lord make us truly grateful, said Aunt Lydia. Or was it thankful? And I start to eat the food. I'm not hungry tonight. I feel sick to my stomach. But there's no place to put the food, no potted plants, and I won't chance the toilet. I'm too nervous, that's what it is. Could I leave it on the plate? Ask Cora not to report me? I chew and swallow, feeling the sweat come out. In my stomach, the food balls itself together, a handful of damp cardboard squeezed. Downstairs in the dining room, there will be candles on the large mahogany table. A white cloth, silver, flowers, wine glasses with wine in them. There will be the click of knives against china, a clink as she sets down her fork, with a barely audible sigh, leaving half the contents of her plate untouched. Possibly, she will say, she has no appetite. Possibly, she won't say anything. If she says something, does he comment? If she doesn't say anything, does he notice? I wonder how she manages to get herself noticed. I think it must be hard. There's a pat of butter on the side of the plate. I tear off a corner of the paper napkin, wrap the butter in it, take it to the cupboard and slip it into the toe of my right shoe from the extra pair as I have done before. I crumple up the rest of the napkin. No one surely will bother to smooth it out to check if any is missing. I will use the butter later tonight. It would not do this evening to smell of butter. I wait. I compose myself. Myself is a thing I must now compose, as one composes a speech. What I must present is a made thing, not something born. 5. Nap. Chapter 13. There's time to spare. This is one of the things I wasn't prepared for. The amount of unfilled time. The long parentheses of nothing. Time as white sound. If only I could embroider, weave, knit, something to do with my hands. I want a cigarette. I remember walking in art galleries through the 19th century. The obsession they had then with harems. Dozens of paintings of harems. Fat women lolling on divans, turbans on their heads or velvet caps, being fanned with peacock tails, a eunuch in the background standing guard. Studies of sedentary flesh, painted by men who'd never been there. These pictures were supposed to be erotic, and I thought they were at the time. But I see now what they were really about. They were paintings about suspended animation, about waiting, about objects not in use. They were paintings about boredom. But maybe boredom is erotic when women do it for men. I wait, washed, brushed, fed, like a prize pig. Sometime in the 80s, they invented pig balls for pigs who were being fattened in pens. Pig balls were large colored balls. The pigs rolled them around with their snouts. The pig marketer said this improved their muscle tone. The pigs were curious. They liked to have something to think about. I read about that in Introduction to Psychology. That and the chapter on caged rats who'd give themselves electric shocks for something to do. And the one on the pigeons, trained to peck a button that made a grain of corn appear. Three groups of them. The first got one grain per peck. The second, one grain every other peck. The third was random. When the man in charge cut off the grain, the first group gave up quite soon. The second group a little later. The third group never gave up. They'd peck themselves to death rather than quit. Who knew what worked? I wish I had a pig ball. I lie down on the braided rug. You can always practice, said Aunt Lydia. Several sessions a day fitted into your daily routine. Arms at the sides, knees bent, lift the pelvis, roll the backbone down, tuck, again. Breathe in to the count of five, hold, expel. We'd do that in what used to be the domestic science room, cleared now of sewing machines and washer dryers, in unison, lying on little Japanese mats, a tape playing Les Sylphides. That's what I hear now in my head as I lift, tilt, breathe. Behind my closed eyes, thin white dancers flit gracefully among the trees, their legs fluttering like the wings of held birds. In the afternoons, we lay on our beds for an hour in the gymnasium between 3 and 4. They said it was a period of rest and meditation. I thought then they did it because they wanted some time off themselves from teaching us, and I know the aunts not on duty went off to the teacher's room for a cup of coffee or whatever they called by that name. But now I think that the rest was also practice. They were giving us a chance to get used to blank time. A catnap, Aunt Lydia called it, in her coy way. The strange thing is we needed the rest. Many of us went to sleep. We were tired there a lot of the time. We were on some kind of pill or drug, I think. They put it in the food to keep us calm. But maybe not. Maybe it was the place itself. After the first shock, after you'd come to terms, it was better to be lethargic. You could tell yourself you were saving up your strength. I must have been there 3 weeks when Moira came. She was brought into the gymnasium by two of the aunts in the usual way, while we were having our nap. She still had her clothes on, jeans and a blue sweatshirt. Her hair was short. She defied fashion as usual, so I recognized her at once. She saw me too, but she turned away. She already knew what was safe. There was a bruise on her left cheek, turning purple. The aunts took her to a vacant bed where the red dress was already laid out. She undressed, began to dress again, in silence, the aunt standing at the end of the bed, the rest of us watching from inside our slitted eyes. As she bent over, I could see the knobs on her spine. I couldn't talk to her for several days. We looked only, small glances, like sips. Friendships were suspicious, we knew it. We avoided each other during the mealtime lineups in the cafeteria and in the halls between classes. But on the fourth day, she was beside me during the walk, 2 by 2 around the football field. We weren't given the white wings until we graduated. We had only the veils, so we could talk as long as we did it quietly and didn't turn to look at one another. The aunts walked at the head of the line and at the end, so the only danger was from the others. Some were believers and might report us. This is a loony bin, Moira said. I'm so glad to see you, I said. Where can we talk, said Moira. Washroom, I said. Watch the clock. End stall, 2:30. That was all we said. It makes me feel safer that Moira is here. We can go to the washroom if we put our hands up, though there's a limit to how many times a day. They mark it down on a chart. I watch the clock, electric and round, at the front over the green blackboard. 2:30 comes during testifying. Aunt Helena is here, as well as Aunt Lydia, because testifying is special. Aunt Helena is fat. She once headed a Weight Watchers franchise operation in Iowa. She's good at testifying. It's Janine, telling about how she was gang-raped at 14 and had an abortion. She told the same story last week. She seemed almost proud of it while she was telling. It may not even be true. At testifying, it's safer to make things up than to say you have nothing to reveal. But since it's Janine, it's probably more or less true. But whose fault was it? Aunt Helena says, holding up one plump finger. Her fault! Her fault! Her fault! We chant in unison. Who led them on? Aunt Helena beams, pleased with us. She did. She did. She did. Why did God allow such a terrible thing to happen? Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Teach her a lesson. Last week, Janine burst into tears. Aunt Helena made her kneel at the front of the classroom, hands behind her back, where we could all see her, her red face and dripping nose, her hair dull blonde, her eyelashes so light they seemed not there, the lost eyelashes of someone who's been in a fire, burned eyes. She looked disgusting, weak, squirmy, blotchy, pink, like a newborn mouse. None of us wanted to look like that ever. For a moment, even though we knew what was being done to her, we despised her. Cry baby. Cry baby. Cry baby. We meant it, which is the bad part. I used to think well of myself. I didn't then. That was last week. This week, Janine doesn't wait for us to jeer at her. It was my fault, she says. It was my own fault. I led them on. I deserved the pain. Very good, Janine, says Aunt Lydia. You are an example. I have to wait until this is over before I put up my hand. Sometimes if you ask at the wrong moment, they say no. If you really have to go, that can be crucial. Yesterday, Dolores wet the floor. Two aunts hauled her away, a hand under each armpit. She wasn't there for the afternoon walk, but at night she was back in her usual bed. All night we could hear her moaning, off and on. What did they do to her? We whispered from bed to bed. I don't know. Not knowing makes it worse. I raise my hand. Aunt Lydia nods. I stand up and walk out into the hall as inconspicuously as possible. Outside the washroom, Aunt Elizabeth is standing guard. She nods, signaling that I can go in. This washroom used to be for boys. The mirrors have been replaced here, too, by oblongs of dull gray metal, but the urinals are still there. On one wall, white enamel with yellow stains. They look oddly like babies' coffins. I marvel again at the nakedness of men's lives. The showers right out in the open, the body exposed for inspection and comparison, the public display of privates. What is it for? What purposes of reassurance does it serve? The flashing of a badge. Look, everyone, all is in order. I belong here. Why don't women have to prove to one another that they are women? Some form of unbuttoning, some split crotch routine, just as casual. A dog-like sniffing. The high school is old. The stalls are wooden, some kind of chipboard. I go into the second one from the end, swing the door to. Of course, there are no longer any locks. In the wood, there's a small hole at the back next to the wall, about waist height. Souvenir of some previous vandalism or legacy of an ancient voyeur. Everyone in the center knows about this hole in the woodwork. Everyone except the aunts. I'm afraid I'm too late, held up by Janine's testifying. Maybe Moira has been here already. Maybe she's had to go back. They don't give you much time. I look carefully down, aslant, under the stall wall, and there are two red shoes. But how can I tell who it is? I put my mouth to the wooden hole. Moira, I whisper. Is that you, she says. Yes, I say. Relief goes through me. God, do I need a cigarette, says Moira. Me too, I say. I feel ridiculously happy. I sink down into my body as into a swamp. Fenland, where only I know the footing. Treacherous ground, my own territory. I become the earth I set my ear against for rumors of the future. Each twinge, each murmur of slight pain, ripples of sloughed-off matter, swellings and diminishings of tissue, the droolings of the flesh, these are signs, these are the things I need to know about. Each month I watch for blood, fearfully, for when it comes, it means failure. I have failed, once again, to fulfill the expectations of others, which have become my own. I used to think of my body as an instrument, of pleasure, or a means of transportation, or an implement for the accomplishment of my will. I could use it to run, push buttons of one sort or another, make things happen. There were limits, but my body was nevertheless lithe, single, solid, one with me. Now the flesh arranges itself differently. I'm a cloud, congealed around a central object, the shape of a pear, which is hard and more real than I am and glows red within its translucent wrapping. Inside it is a space, huge as the sky at night and dark and curved like that, though black-red rather than black. Pinpoints of light swell, sparkle, burst and shrivel within it, countless as stars. Every month there is a moon, gigantic, round, heavy, an omen. It transits, pauses, continues on, and passes out of sight. And I see despair coming towards me like famine. To feel that empty again, again. I listen to my heart, wave upon wave, salty and red, continuing on and on, marking time. I'm in our first apartment, in the bedroom. I'm standing in front of the cupboard, which has folding doors made of wood. Around me, I know it's empty. All the furniture is gone, the floors are bare, no carpets even. But despite this, the cupboard is full of clothes. I think they're my clothes, but they don't look like mine. I've never seen them before. Maybe they're clothes belonging to Luke's wife, whom I've also never seen, only pictures and a voice on the phone, late at night, when she was calling us, before the divorce. But no, they're my clothes, all right. I need a dress. I need something to wear. I pull out dresses, black, blue, purple, jackets, skirts. None of them will do. None of them even fits. They're too big or too small. Luke is there, behind me. I turn to see him. He won't look at me. He looks down at the floor where the cat is rubbing itself against his legs, mewing and mewing plaintively. It wants food, but how can there be any food with the apartment so empty? Luke, I say. He doesn't answer. Maybe he doesn't hear me. It occurs to me that he may not be alive. I'm running with her, holding her hand, pulling, dragging her through the bracken. She's only half awake because of the pill I gave her so she wouldn't cry or say anything that would give us away. She doesn't know where she is. The ground is uneven, rocks, dead branches, the smell of damp earth, old leaves. She can't run fast enough. By myself, I could run faster. I'm a good runner. Now she's crying. She's frightened. I want to carry her, but she would be too heavy. I have my hiking boots on, and I think, when we reach the water, I'll have to kick them off. Will it be too cold? Will she be able to swim that far? What about the current? We weren't expecting this. Quiet, I say to her angrily. I think about her drowning, and this thought slows me. Then the shots come behind us, not loud, not like firecrackers, but sharp and crisp, like a dry branch snapping. It sounds wrong. Nothing ever sounds the way you think it will, and I hear the voice. Down! Is it a real voice, or a voice inside my head, or my own voice out loud? I pull her to the ground and roll on top of her to cover her, shield her. Quiet, I say again. My face is wet, sweat or tears. I feel calm and floating as if I'm no longer in my body. Close to my eyes, there's a leaf, red, turned early. I can see every bright vein. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. I ease off. I don't want to smother her. Instead, I curl myself around her, keeping my hand over her mouth. There's breath and the knocking of my heart, like pounding at the door of a house at night where you thought you would be safe. It's all right, I'm here, I say, whisper. Please be quiet. But how can she? She's too young. It's too late. We come apart. My arms are held. and the edges go dark and nothing is left but a little window, a very little window, like the wrong end of a telescope, like the window on a Christmas card, an old one. Night and ice outside, and within a candle, a shining tree, a family. I can hear the bells even, sleigh bells from the radio, old music. But through this window I can see, small, but very clear, I can see her going away from me through the trees which are already turning red and yellow, holding out her arms to me, being carried away. The bell awakens me, and then Cora, knocking at my door. I sit up on the rug, wipe my wet face with my sleeve. Of all the dreams, this is the worst. 6. Household. Chapter 14. When the bell is finished, I descend the stairs, a brief waif in the eye of glass that hangs on the downstairs wall. The clock ticks with its pendulum, keeping time. My feet, in their neat red shoes, count the way down. The sitting room door is wide open. I go in. So far, no one else is here. I don't sit, but take my place, kneeling near the chair with the footstool where Serena Joy will shortly enthrone herself, leaning on her cane while she lowers herself down. Possibly she'll put a hand on my shoulder to steady herself, as if I'm a piece of furniture. She's done it before. The sitting room would once have been called a drawing room, perhaps, then a living room. Or maybe it's a parlor, the kind with a spider and flies. But now it's officially a sitting room, because that's what is done in it, by some. For others, there's standing room only. The posture of the body is important. Here and now. Minor discomforts are instructive. The sitting room is subdued, symmetrical. It's one of the shapes money takes when it freezes. Money has trickled through this room for years and years, as if through an underground cavern, crusting and hardening like stalactites into these forms. Mutely, the varied surfaces present themselves. The dusk rose velvet of the drawn drapes, the gloss of the matching chairs, 18th century, the cow's tongue hush of the tufted Chinese rug on the floor, with its peach pink peonies, the suave leather of the commander's chair, the glint of brass on the box beside it. The rug is authentic. Some things in this room are authentic, some are not. For instance, two paintings, both of women, one on either side of the fireplace. Both wear dark dresses, like the ones in the old church, though of a later date. The paintings are possibly authentic. I suspect that when Serena Joy acquired them, after it became obvious to her that she'd have to redirect her energies into something convincingly domestic, she had the intention of passing them off as ancestors. Or maybe they were in the house when the commander bought it. There's no way of knowing such things. In any case, there they hang, their backs and mouths stiff, their breasts constricted, their faces pinched, their caps starched, their skin grayish-white, guarding the room with their narrowed eyes. Between them, over the mantel, there's an oval mirror, flanked by two pairs of silver candlesticks, with a white china Cupid centered between them, its arm around the neck of a lamb. The tastes of Serena Joy are a strange blend. Hard lust for quality. Soft, sentimental cravings. There's a dried flower arrangement on either end of the mantelpiece, and a vase of real daffodils on the polished marquetry end table beside the sofa. The room smells of lemon oil, heavy cloth, fading daffodils, the leftover smells of cooking that have made their way from the kitchen or the dining room, and of Serena Joy's perfume, Lily of the Valley. Perfume is a luxury. She must have some private source. I breathe it in, thinking I should appreciate it. It's the scent of prepubescent girls, of the gifts young children used to give their mothers for Mother's Day, the smell of white cotton socks and white cotton petticoats, of dusting powder, of the innocence of female flesh not yet given over to hairiness and blood. It makes me feel slightly ill, as if I'm in a closed car on a hot, muggy day with an older woman wearing too much face powder. This is what the sitting room is like, despite its elegance. I would like to steal something from this room. I would like to take some small thing, the scrolled ashtray, the little silver pillbox from the mantel, perhaps, or a dried flower, hide it in the folds of my dress or in my zippered sleeve, keep it there until this evening is over, secret it in my room, under the bed, or in a shoe, or in a slit in the hard, petty-point faith cushion. Every once in a while I would take it out and look at it. It would make me feel that I have power. But such a feeling would be an illusion and too risky. My hands stay where they are, folded in my lap. Thighs together, heels tucked underneath me, pressing up against my body, head lowered. In my mouth there's a taste of toothpaste, fake mint, and plaster. I wait for the household to assemble. Household. That is what we are. The commander is the head of the household. The house is what he holds. To have and to hold, till death do us part. The hold of a ship. Hollow. Cora comes in first, then Rita, wiping her hands on her apron. They too have been summoned by the bell. They resent it. They have other things to do, the dishes, for instance. But they need to be here. They all need to be here. The ceremony demands it. We are all obliged to sit through this one way or another. Rita scowls at me before slipping in to stand behind me. It's my fault, this waste of her time. Not mine, but my body's, if there is a difference. Even the commander is subject to its whims. Nick walks in, nods to all three of us, looks around the room. He too takes his place behind me, standing. He's so close that the tip of his boot is touching my foot. Is this on purpose? Whether it is or not, we are touching. Two shapes of leather. I feel my shoe soften. Blood flows into it. It grows warm. It becomes a skin. I move my foot slightly, away. "Wish he'd hurry up," says Cora. "Hurry up and wait," says Nick. He laughs, moves his foot so it's touching mine again. No one can see, beneath the folds of my outspread skirt. I shift. It's too warm in here. The smell of stale perfume makes me feel a little sick. I move my foot away. We hear Serena coming down the stairs along the hall, the muffled tap of her cane on the rug, thud of the good foot. She hobbles through the doorway, glances at us, counting but not seeing. She nods at Nick, but says nothing. She's in one of her best dresses, sky blue with embroidery in white along the edges of the veil, flowers and fretwork. Even at her age, she still feels the urge to wreathe herself in flowers. "No use for you," I think at her, my face unmoving. "You can't use them anymore. You're withered. They're the genital organs of plants. I read that somewhere once." She makes her way to her chair and footstool, turns, lowers herself, lands ungracefully. She hoists her left foot onto the stool, fumbles in her sleeve pocket. I can hear the rustling, the click of her lighter. I smell the hot singe of the smoke, breathe it in. "Late as usual," she says. We don't answer. There's a clatter as she gropes on the lamp table, then a click, and the television set runs through its warm-up. A male choir with greenish-yellow skin. The color needs adjusting. They're singing, "Come to the church in the wildwood." "Come, come, come, come," sing the basses. Serena clicks the channel changer. Waves, colored zigzags, a garble of sound. It's the Montreal satellite station being blocked. Then there's a preacher, earnest, with shining dark eyes leaning towards us across a desk. These days they look a lot like businessmen. Serena gives him a few seconds, then clicks onward. Several blank channels, then the news. This is what she's been looking for. She leans back, inhales deeply. I, on the contrary, lean forward, a child being allowed up late with the grown-ups. This is the one good thing about these evenings, the evenings of the ceremony. I'm allowed to watch the news. It seems to be an unspoken rule in this household. We always get here on time, he's always late. Serena always lets us watch the news. Such as it is. Who knows if any of it's true? It could be old clips, it could be faked. But I watch it anyway, hoping to be able to read beneath it. Any news now is better than none. First, the front lines. They're not lines, really. The war seems to be going on in many places at once. Wooded hills, seen from above, the trees a sickly yellow. I wish she'd fix the color. The Appalachian Highlands, says the voiceover, where the Angels of the Apocalypse, 4th Division, are smoking out a pocket of Baptist guerrillas with air support from the 21st Battalion of the Angels of Light. We are shown two helicopters, black ones with silver wings painted on the sides. Below them, a clump of trees explodes. Now a close shot of a prisoner, with a stubbled and dirty face, flanked by two angels in their neat black uniforms. The prisoner accepts a cigarette from one of the angels, puts it awkwardly to his lips with his bound hands. He gives a lopsided little grin. The announcer is saying something, but I don't hear it. I look into this man's eyes, trying to decide what he's thinking. He knows the camera is on him. Is the grin a show of defiance, or is it submission? Is he embarrassed at having been caught? They only show us victories, never defeats. Who wants bad news? Possibly he's an actor. The anchorman comes on now. His manner is kindly, fatherly. He gazes out at us from the screen, looking with his tan and his white hair and candid eyes, wise wrinkles around them, like everybody's ideal grandfather. What he's telling us, his level smile implies, is for our own good. Everything will be all right soon. I promise. There will be peace. You must trust. You must go to sleep, like good children. He tells us what we long to believe. He's very convincing. I struggle against him. He's like an old movie star, I tell myself, with false teeth and a face job. At the same time, I sway towards him like one hypnotized. If only it were true. If only I could believe. Now he's telling us that an underground espionage ring has been cracked by a team of eyes, working with an inside informant. The ring has been smuggling precious national resources over the border into Canada. 5 members of the heretical sect of Quakers have been arrested, he says, smiling blandly. And more arrests are anticipated. 2 of the Quakers appear on screen, a man and a woman. They look terrified, but they're trying to preserve some dignity in front of the camera. The man has a large dark mark on his forehead. The woman's veil has been torn off and her hair falls in strands over her face. Both of them are about 50. Now we can see a city, again from the air. This used to be Detroit. Under the voice of the announcer, there's the thunk of artillery. From the skyline, columns of smoke ascend. Resettlement of the children of Ham is continuing on schedule, says the reassuring pink face back on the screen. 3,000 have arrived this week in National Homeland 1, with another 2,000 in transit. How are they transporting that many people at once? Trains? Buses? We are not shown any pictures of this. National Homeland 1 is in North Dakota. Lord knows what they're supposed to do once they get there. Farm is the theory. Serena Joy has had enough of the news. Impatiently, she clicks the button for a station change, comes up with an aging bass baritone, his cheeks like emptied udders. Whispering hope is what he's singing. Serena turns him off. We wait. The clock in the hall ticks. Serena lights another cigarette. I get into the car. It's a Saturday morning. It's a September. We still have a car. Other people have had to sell theirs. My name isn't Ufred. I have another name, which nobody uses now because it's forbidden. I tell myself it doesn't matter. Your name is like your telephone number, useful only to others. But what I tell myself is wrong. It does matter. I keep the knowledge of this name like something hidden, some treasure I'll come back to dig up one day. I think of this name as buried. This name has an aura around it, like an amulet, some charm that survived from an unimaginably distant past. I lie in my single bed at night with my eyes closed, and the name floats there behind my eyes, not quite within reach, shining in the dark. It's a Saturday morning in September. I'm wearing my shining name. The little girl who is now dead sits in the back seat with her two best dolls, her stuffed rabbit, mangy with age and love. I know all the details. They are sentimental details, but I can't help that. I can't think about the rabbit too much, though. I can't start to cry. Here, on the Chinese rug, breathing in the smoke that has been inside Serena's body. Not here. Not now. I can do that later. She thought we were going on a picnic. And in fact, there is a picnic basket on the back seat beside her, with real food in it. Hard-boiled eggs, thermos and all. We didn't want her to know where we were really going. We didn't want her to tell, by mistake, reveal anything if we were stopped. We didn't want to lay upon her the burden of our truth. I wore my hiking boots. She had on her sneakers. The laces of the sneakers had a design of hearts on them, red, purple, pink, and yellow. It was warm for the time of year. The leaves were turning already, some of them. Luke drove. I sat beside him. The sun shone. The sky was blue. The houses as we passed them looked comforting and ordinary. Each house as it was left behind vanishing into past time, crumbling in an instant, as if it had never been, because I would never see it again. Or so I thought then. We have almost nothing with us. We don't want to look as if we're going anywhere far or permanent. We have the forged passports, guaranteed worth the price. We couldn't pay in money, of course, or put it on the CompuCount. We used other things. Some jewelry that was my grandmother's, a stamp collection Luke inherited from his uncle. Such things can be exchanged for money in other countries. When we get to the border, we'll pretend we're just going over on a day trip. The fake visas are for a day. Before that, I'll give her a sleeping pill so she'll be asleep when we cross. That way, she won't betray us. You can't expect a child to lie convincingly. And I don't want her to feel frightened, to feel the fear that is now tightening my muscles, tensing my spine, pulling me so taut that I'm certain I would break if touched. Every stoplight is an ordeal. We'll spend the night at a motel, or better, sleeping in the car on a side road so there will be no suspicious questions. We'll cross in the morning, drive over the bridge easily, just like driving to the supermarket. We turn onto the freeway, head north, flowing with not much traffic. Since the war started, gas is expensive and in short supply. Outside the city, we pass the first checkpoint. All they want is a look at the license. Luke does it well. The license matches the passport. We thought of that. Back on the road, he squeezes my hand, glances over at me. "You're white as a sheet," he says. That is how I feel. White. Flat. Thin. I feel transparent. Surely they will be able to see through me. Worse, how will I be able to hold on to Luke, to her, when I'm so flat, so white? I feel as if there's not much left of me. They will slip through my arms, as if I'm made of smoke, as if I'm a mirage, fading before their eyes. "Don't think that way," Moira would say. Think that way and you'll make it happen. Cheer up, says Luke. He's driving a little too fast now. The adrenaline's gone to his head. Now he's singing. Oh, what a beautiful morning, he sings. Even his singing worries me. We've been warned not to look too happy. Chapter 15. The commander knocks at the door. The knock is prescribed. The sitting room is supposed to be Serena Joy's territory. He's supposed to ask permission to enter it. She likes to keep him waiting. It's a little thing, but in this household, little things mean a lot. Tonight, however, she doesn't even get that, because before Serena Joy can speak, he steps forward into the room anyway. Maybe he's just forgotten the protocol, but maybe it's deliberate. Who knows what she said to him over the silver-encrusted dinner table, or didn't say. The commander has on his black uniform, in which he looks like a museum guard. A semi-retired man, genial but wary, killing time. But only at first glance. After that, he looks like a Midwestern bank president, with his straight, neatly brushed silver hair, his sober posture, shoulders a little stooped. And after that, there is his mustache, silver also, and after that, his chin, which really you can't miss. When you get down as far as the chin, he looks like a vodka ad in a glossy magazine of times gone by. His manner is mild, his hands large, with thick fingers and acquisitive thumbs. His blue eyes uncommunicative, falsely innocuous. He looks us over as if taking inventory. One kneeling woman in red, one seated woman in blue, two in green, standing, a solitary man, thin-faced, in the background. He manages to appear puzzled, as if he can't quite remember how we all got in here, as if we were something he inherited, like a Victorian pump organ, and he hasn't figured out what to do with us, what we are worth. He nods in the general direction of Serena Joy, who does not make a sound. He crosses to the large leather chair reserved for him, takes the key out of his pocket, fumbles with the ornate, brass-bound, leather-covered box that stands on the table beside the chair. He inserts the key, opens the box, lifts out the Bible, an ordinary copy with a black cover and gold-edged pages. The Bible is kept locked up, the way people once kept tea locked up, so the servants wouldn't steal it. It is an incendiary device. Who knows what we'd make of it, if we ever got our hands on it. We can be read to from it, by him, but we cannot read. Our heads turn towards him. We are expectant. Here comes our bedtime story. The commander sits down and crosses his legs, watched by us. The bookmarks are in place. He opens the book. He clears his throat a little, as if embarrassed. Could I have a drink of water? He says to the air. Please, he adds. Behind me, one of them, Cora or Rita, leaves her space in the tableau and pads off towards the kitchen. The commander sits, looking down. The commander sighs, takes out a pair of reading glasses from his inside jacket pocket, gold rims, slips them on. Now he looks like a shoemaker in an old fairy tale book. Is there no end to his disguises of benevolence? We watch him, every inch, every flicker. To be a man watched by women, it must be entirely strange to have them watching him all the time, to have them wondering, what's he going to do next? To have them flinch when he moves, even if it's a harmless enough move, to reach for an ashtray, perhaps. To have them sizing him up. To have them thinking. He can't do it. He won't do. He'll have to do. This last, as if he were a garment, out of style or shoddy, which must nevertheless be put on because there's nothing else available. to have them putting him on, trying him on, trying him out, while he himself puts them on like a sock over a foot, onto the stub of himself, his extra sensitive thumb, his tentacle, his delicate, stalked slug's eye, which extrudes, expands, winces, and shrivels back into himself when touched wrongly, grows big again, bulging a little at the tip, traveling forward as if along a leaf, into them, avid for vision. To achieve vision in this way, this journey into a darkness that is composed of women, a woman, who can see in darkness while he himself strains blindly forward. She watches him from within. We're all watching him. It's the one thing we can really do, and it's not for nothing. If he were to falter, fail, or die, what would become of us? No wonder he's like a boot, hard on the outside, giving shape to a pulp of tender foot. That's just a wish. I've been watching him for some time, and he's given no evidence of softness. But watch out, Commander, I tell him in my head. I've got my eye on you. One false move, and I'm dead. Still, it must be hell to be a man like that. It must be just fine. It must be hell. It must be very silent. The water appears. The commander drinks it. Thank you, he says. Cora rustles back into place. The commander pauses, looking down, scanning the page. He takes his time, as if unconscious of us. He's like a man toying with a steak behind a restaurant window, pretending not to see the eyes watching him from hungry darkness, not 3 feet from his elbow. We lean towards him a little, iron filings to his magnet. He has something we don't have. He has the word. How we squandered it once. The commander, as if reluctantly, begins to read. He isn't very good at it. Maybe he's merely bored. It's the usual story, the usual stories. God to Adam, God to Noah. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Then comes the moldy old Rachel and Leah stuff we had drummed into us at the center. Give me children, or else I die. Am I in God's stead, who hath withheld from thee the fruit of the womb? Behold my maid, Bilhah. She shall bear upon my knees, that I may also have children by her. And so on and so forth. We had it read to us every breakfast, as we sat in the high school cafeteria, eating porridge with cream and brown sugar. You're getting the best, you know, said Aunt Lydia. There's a war on, things are rationed. You are spoiled girls, she twinkled, as if rebuking a kitten. Naughty puss. For lunch, it was the Beatitudes. Blessed be this, blessed be that. They played it from a tape, so not even an aunt would be guilty of the sin of reading. The voice was a man's. Blessed be the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed be the meek. Blessed are the silent. I knew they made that up. I knew it was wrong, and they left things out, too, but there was no way of checking. Blessed be those that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Nobody said when. I check the clock during dessert. Canned pears with cinnamon standard for lunch, and look for Moira in her place, 2 tables over. She's gone already. I put my hand up. I am excused. We don't do this too often, and always at different times of day. In the washroom, I go to the second last stall, as usual. Are you there? I whisper. Large as life and twice as ugly, Moira whispers back. What have you heard? I ask her. Nothing much. I've got to get out of here. I'm going bats. I feel panic. No, no, Moira, I say, don't try it. Not on your own. I'll fake sick. They send an ambulance, I've seen it. You'll only get as far as the hospital. At least it'll be a change. You won't have to listen to that old bitch. They'll find you out. Not to worry, I'm good at it. When I was a kid in high school, I cut out vitamin C, I got scurvy. In the early stages, they can't diagnose it. Then you just start it again and you're fine. I'll hide my vitamin pills. Moira, don't. I couldn't stand the thought of her not being here with me. For me. They sent two guys with you in the ambulance. Think about it. They must be starved for it. Shit, they aren't even allowed to put their hands in their pockets. The possibilities are... You in there! Time's up, said the voice of Aunt Elizabeth from the doorway. I stood up, flushed the toilet. Two of Moira's fingers appeared through the hole in the wall. It was only large enough for two fingers. I touched my own fingers to them, quickly, held on. Let go. And Leah said, God hath given me my hire, because I have given my maiden to my husband, says the commander. He lets the book fall closed. It makes an exhausted sound, like a padded door shutting by itself at a distance, a puff of air. The sound suggests the softness of the thin, oniony pages, how they would feel under the fingers. Soft and dry, like papier poudre. Pink and powdery from the time before. You'd get it in booklets for taking the shine off your nose, in those stores that sold candles and soap in the shapes of things. Seashells, mushrooms, like cigarette paper, like petals. The commander sits with his eyes closed for a moment, as if tired. He works long hours. He has a lot of responsibilities. Serena has begun to cry. I can hear her behind my back. It isn't the first time. She always does this the night of the ceremony. She's trying not to make a noise. She's trying to preserve her dignity in front of us. The upholstery and the rugs muffle her, but we can hear her clearly despite that. The tension between her lack of control and her attempt to suppress it is horrible. It's like a fart in church. I feel, as always, the urge to laugh, but not because I think it's funny. The smell of her crying spreads over us, and we pretend to ignore it. The commander opens his eyes, notices, frowns, ceases to notice. Now we will have a moment of silent prayer, says the commander. We will ask for a blessing and for success in all our ventures. I bow my head and close my eyes. I listen to the held breath, the almost inaudible gasps, the shaking going on behind my back. How she must hate me, I think. I pray silently. Nolite te bastardes carborundorum. I don't know what it means, but it sounds right, and it'll have to do, because I don't know what else I can say to God. Not right now. Not, as they used to say, at this juncture. The scratched writing on my cupboard wall floats before me, left by an unknown woman with a face of Moira. I saw her go out to the ambulance on a stretcher carried by two angels. What is it? I mouthed to the woman beside me. Safe enough, a question like that, to all but a fanatic. A fever, she formed with her lips. Appendicitis, they say. I was having dinner that evening, hamburger balls and hash browns. My table was near the window. I could see out as far as the front gates. I saw the ambulance come back, no siren this time. One of the angels jumped out, talked with the guard. The guard went into the building. The ambulance stayed parked. The angel stood with his back towards us, as they had been taught to do. Two of the aunts came out of the building with the guard. They went around to the back. They hauled Moira out, dragged her in through the gate and up the front steps, holding her under the armpits, one on each side. She was having trouble walking. I stopped eating. I couldn't eat. By this time, all of us on my side of the table were staring out the window. The window was greenish, with that chicken wire mesh they used to put inside glass. Aunt Lydia said, Eat your dinner. She went over and pulled down the blind. They took her into the room that used to be the science lab. It was a room where none of us ever went willingly. Afterward, she could not walk for a week. Her feet would not fit into her shoes. They were too swollen. It was the feet they'd do for a first offense. They'd use steel cables frayed at the ends. After that, the hands. They didn't care what they did to your feet or your hands, even if it was permanent. Remember, said Aunt Lydia, for our purposes, your feet and your hands are not essential. Moira lay on her bed, an example. She shouldn't have tried it, not with the angels, Alma said from the next bed over. We had to carry her to classes. We stole extra paper packets of sugar for her from the cafeteria at mealtimes, smuggled them to her at night, handing them from bed to bed. Probably she didn't need the sugar, but it was the only thing we could find to steal. To give. I'm still praying, but what I'm seeing is Moira's feet, the way they looked after they'd brought her back. Her feet did not look like feet at all. They looked like drowned feet, swollen and boneless, except for the color. They looked like lungs. Oh God, I pray. Nolite de bastardes carborundorum. Is this what you had in mind? The commander clears his throat. This is what he does to let us know that, in his opinion, it's time we stop praying. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to know himself strong in the behalf of them whose heart is perfect towards him, he says. It's the sign-off. He stands up. We are dismissed. Chapter 16. The ceremony goes as usual. I lie on my back, fully clothed, except for the healthy white cotton underdrawers. What I could see if I were to open my eyes would be the large white canopy of Serena Joy's outsized colonial-style four-poster bed, suspended like a sagging cloud above us. A cloud sprigged with tiny drops of silver rain, which, if you looked at them closely, would turn out to be four-petaled flowers. I would not see the carpet, which is white, or the sprigged curtains and skirted dressing table with its silver-backed brush and mirror set. Only the canopy, which manages to suggest at one and the same time, by the gauziness of its fabric and its heavy downward curve, both ethereality and matter. Or the sail of a ship. Big-bellied sails, they used to say in poems. Bellying, propelled forward by a swollen belly. A mist of lily of the valley surrounds us, chilly, crisp almost. It's not warm in this room. Above me, towards the head of the bed, Serena Joy is arranged, outspread. Her legs are apart. I lie between them, my head on her stomach, her pubic bone under the base of my skull, her thighs on either side of me. She too is fully clothed. My arms are raised. She holds my hands, each of mine and each of hers. This is supposed to signify that we are one flesh, one being. What it really means is that she is in control of the process and thus of the product, if any. The rings of her left hand cut into my fingers. It may or may not be revenge. My red skirt is hitched up to my waist, though no higher. Below it, the commander is fucking. What he is fucking is the lower part of my body. I do not say making love, because this is not what he's doing. Copulating, too, would be inaccurate, because it would imply two people and only one is involved. Nor does rape cover it. Nothing is going on here that I haven't signed up for. There wasn't a lot of choice, but there was some, and this is what I chose. Therefore, I lie still and picture the unseen canopy over my head. I remember Queen Victoria's advice to her daughter. Close your eyes and think of England. But this is not England. I wish he would hurry up. Maybe I'm crazy, and this is some new kind of therapy. I wish it were true. Then I could get better, and this would go away. Serena Joy grips my hands as if it is she, not I, who's being fucked, as if she finds it either pleasurable or painful, and the commander fucks with a regular 2-4 marching stroke on and on like a tap dripping. He is preoccupied, like a man humming to himself in the shower without knowing he's humming, like a man who has other things on his mind. It's as if he's somewhere else, waiting for himself to come, drumming his fingers on the table while he waits. There's an impatience in his rhythm now. But isn't this everyone's wet dream? Two women at once? They used to say that. Exciting, they used to say. What's going on in this room, under Serena Joy's silvery canopy, is not exciting. It has nothing to do with passion or love or romance or any of those other notions we used to titillate ourselves with. It has nothing to do with sexual desire, at least for me, and certainly not for Serena. Arousal and orgasm are no longer thought necessary. They would be a symptom of frivolity, merely, like jazz garters or beauty spots, superfluous distractions for the light-minded, outdated. It seems odd that women once spent such time and energy reading about such things, thinking about them, worrying about them, writing about them. They are so obviously recreational. This is not recreation, even for the commander. This is serious business. The commander, too, is doing his duty. If I were going to open my eyes a slit, I would be able to see him, his not unpleasant face hanging over my torso, with a few strands of his silver hair falling perhaps over his forehead, intent on his inner journey, that place he is hurrying towards, which recedes as in a dream at the same speed with which he approaches it. I would see his open eyes. If he were better looking, would I enjoy this more? At least he's an improvement on the previous one, who smelled like a church cloakroom in the rain, like your mouth when the dentist starts picking at your teeth, like a nostril. The commander, instead, smells of mothballs. Or is this odor some punitive form of aftershave? Why does he have to wear that stupid uniform? But would I like his white, tufted, raw body any better? Kissing is forbidden between us. This makes it bearable. One detaches oneself. One describes. He comes at last, with a stifled groan as of relief. Serena Joy, who has been holding her breath, expels it. The commander, who has been propping himself on his elbows away from our combined bodies, doesn't permit himself to sink down into us. He rests a moment, withdraws, recedes, re-zippers. He nods, then turns and leaves the room, closing the door with exaggerated care behind him, as if both of us are his ailing mother. There's something hilarious about this, but I don't dare laugh. Serena Joy lets go of my hands. "You can get up now," she says. "Get up and get out." She's supposed to have me rest for 10 minutes with my feet on a pillow to improve the chances. This is meant to be a time of silent meditation for her, but she's not in the mood for that. There is loathing in her voice, as if the touch of my flesh sickens and contaminates her. I entangle myself from her body. Stand up. The juice of the commander runs down my legs. Before I turn away, I see her straighten her blue skirt, clench her legs together. She continues lying on the bed, gazing up at the canopy above her, stiff and straight as an effigy. Which of us is it worse for? Her? Or me. Chapter 17. This is what I do when I'm back in my room. I take off my clothes and put on my nightgown. I look for the pat of butter in the toe of my right shoe, where I hid it after dinner. The cupboard was too warm. The butter is semi-liquid. Much of it is sunk into the paper napkin I wrapped it in. Now I'll have butter in my shoe. Not the first time, because whenever there is butter or even margarine, I save some in this way. I can get most of the butter off the shoe lining with a washcloth or some toilet paper from the bathroom tomorrow. I rub the butter over my face, work it into the skin of my hands. There's no longer any hand lotion or face cream, not for us. Such things are considered vanities. We are containers. It's only the insides of our bodies that are important. The outside can become hard and wrinkled for all they care, like the shell of a nut. This was a decree of the wives, this absence of hand lotion. They don't want us to look attractive. For them, things are bad enough as it is. The butter is a trick I learned at the Rachel and Leah Center. The Red Center, we called it, because there was so much red. My predecessor in this room, my friend with the freckles and the good laugh, must have done this too, this buttering. We all do it. As long as we do this, butter our skin to keep it soft, we can believe that we will someday get out, that we will be touched again in love or desire. We have ceremonies of our own, private ones. The butter is greasy, and it will go rancid, and I will smell like an old cheese, but at least it's organic, as they used to say. To such devices have we descended. Buttered, I lie on my single bed, flat, like a piece of toast. I can't sleep. In the semi-dark, I stare up at the blind plaster eye in the middle of the ceiling, which stares back down at me, even though it can't see. There's no breeze. My white curtains are like gauze bandages, hanging limp, glimmering in the aura cast by the searchlight that illuminates this house at night. Or is there a moon? I fold back the sheet, get carefully up on silent bare feet in my nightgown, go to the window like a child. I want to see the moon on the breast of the new fallen snow. The sky is clear, but hard to make out because of the searchlight. But yes, in the obscured sky, a moon does float, newly, a wishing moon, a sliver of ancient rock, a goddess, a wink. The moon is a stone, and the sky is full of deadly hardware, but, oh God, how beautiful anyway. I want Luke here so badly. I want to be held and told my name. I want to be valued in ways that I am not. I want to be more than valuable. I repeat my former name, remind myself of what I once could do. How others saw me. I want to steal something. In the hall, the nightlight's on. The long space glows gently pink. I walk, one foot set carefully down, then the other, without creaking, along the runner, as if on a forest floor, sneaking, my heart quick, through the night house. I am out of place. This is entirely illegal. Down past the fisheye on the hall wall, I can see my white shape of tented body, hair down my back like a mane, my eyes gleaming. I like this. I am doing something on my own. The active. Is it a tense? Tensed. What I would like to steal is a knife from the kitchen, but I'm not ready for that. I reach the sitting room. Doors ajar, slip in. Leave the door a little open. A squeak of wood, but who's near enough to hear? I stand in the room, letting the pupils of my eyes dilate, like a cat's or owl's. Old perfume, cloth dust fill my nostrils. There's a slight mist of light coming through the cracks around the closed drapes from the searchlight outside, where two men doubtless patrol. I've seen them from above, from behind my curtains. Dark shapes, cutouts. Now I can see outlines, gleams from the mirror, the bases of the lamps, the vases, the sofa looming like a cloud at dusk. What should I take? Something that will not be missed. In the wood at midnight, a magic flower, a withered daffodil, not one from the dried arrangement. The daffodils will soon be thrown out, they're beginning to smell, along with Serena's stale fumes, the stench of her knitting. I grope, find an end table, feel. There's a clink. I must have knocked something. I find the daffodils, crisp at the edges where they've dried, limp towards the stems, use my fingers to pinch. I will press this somewhere, under the mattress, leave it there for the next woman, the one who comes after me to find. But there's someone in the room behind me. I hear the step, quiet as mine, the creaking of the same floorboard. The door closes behind me with a little click, cutting the light. I freeze. White was a mistake. I'm snow in moonlight, even in the dark. Then a whisper. Don't scream, it's all right. As if I'd scream, as if it's all right. I turn. A shape, that's all. Dull glint of cheekbone, devoid of color. He steps towards me. Nick. What are you doing in here? I don't answer. He too is illegal here with me. He can't give me away, nor I him. For the moment, we're mirrors. He puts his hand on my arm, pulls me against him, his mouth on mine. What else comes from such denial? Without a word. Both of us shaking. How I'd like to. In Serena's parlor with the dried flowers on the Chinese carpet, his thin body. A man entirely unknown. It would be like shouting. It would be like shooting someone. My hand goes down. How about that? I could unbutton. And then. But it's too dangerous. He knows it. We push each other away, not far. Too much trust, too much risk, too much already. I was coming to find you, he says, breathes, almost into my ear. I want to reach up, taste his skin. He makes me hungry. His fingers move, feeling my arm under the nightgown sleeve, as if his hand won't listen to reason. It's so good to be touched by someone, to be felt so greedily, to feel so greedy. Luke, you'd know, you'd understand. It's you here in another body. Bullshit. Why, I say. Is it so bad for him that he'd take the risk of coming to my room at night? I think of the hanged men, hooked on the wall. I can hardly stand up. I have to get away, back to the stairs, before I dissolve entirely. His hands on my shoulder now, held still heavy, pressing down on me like warm lead. Is this what I would die for? I'm a coward. I hate the thought of pain. He told me to, Nick says. He wants to see you, in his office. What do you mean? I say. The commander, it must be. See me? What does he mean by see? Hasn't he had enough of me? Tomorrow, he says, just audible. In the dark parlor, we move away from each other slowly, as if pulled towards each other by a force, current, pulled apart also by hands equally strong. I find the door. Turn the knob, fingers on cool porcelain, open. It's all I can do. 7. Night. Chapter 18. I lie in bed, still trembling. You can wet the rim of a glass and run your finger around the rim and it will make a sound. This is what I feel like. This sound of glass. I feel like the word shatter. I want to be with someone. Lying in bed with Luke, his hand on my rounded belly. The three of us, in bed, she kicking, turning over within me. Thunderstorm outside the window. That's why she's awake. They can hear. They sleep. They can be startled. Even there, in the soothing of the heart, like waves on the shore around them. A flash of lightning, quite close. Luke's eyes go white for an instant. I'm not frightened. We're wide awake. The rain hits now. We will be slow and careful. If I thought this would never happen again, I would die. But this is wrong. Nobody dies from lack of sex. It's lack of love we die from. There's nobody here I can love. All the people I could love are dead or elsewhere. Who knows where they are or what their names are now? They might as well be nowhere, as I am for them. I, too, am a missing person. From time to time I can see their faces against the dark, flickering like the images of saints in old foreign cathedrals, in the light of the drafty candles, candles you would light to pray by, kneeling, your forehead against the wooden railing, hoping for an answer. I can conjure them, but they are mirages only. They don't last. Can I be blamed for wanting a real body to put my arms around? Without it, I too am disembodied. I can listen to my own heartbeat against the bedsprings. I can stroke myself under the dry white sheets in the dark. But I too am dry and white, hard, granular. It's like running my hand over a plateful of dried rice. It's like snow. There's something dead about it, something deserted. I'm like a room where things once happened and now nothing does, except the pollen of the weeds that grow up outside the window, blowing in as dust across the floor. Here is what I believe. I believe Luke is lying face down in a thicket, a tangle of bracken, the brown fronds from last year under the green ones just unrolled, or ground hemlock, perhaps, although it's too early for the red berries. What is left of him? His hair, the bones, the plaid wool shirt, green and black, the leather belt, the work boots. I know exactly what he was wearing. I can see his clothes in my mind, bright as a lithograph, or a full-color advertisement from an ancient magazine. Though not his face, not so well. His face is beginning to fade. Possibly because it wasn't always the same. His face had different expressions. His clothes did not. I pray that the hole, or two or three, there was more than one shot. They were close together. I pray that at least one hole is neatly, quickly, and finally through the skull, through the place where all the pictures were, so that there would have been only the one flash of darkness or pain. Dull, I hope, like the word thud. Only the one, and then silence. I believe this. I also believe that Luke is sitting up in a rectangle somewhere, gray cement on a ledge or the edge of something, a bed or chair. God knows what he's wearing. God knows what they've put him in. God isn't the only one who knows, so maybe there could be some way of finding out. He hasn't shaved for a year, though they cut his hair short whenever they feel like it, for lice, they say. I'll have to revise that. If they cut the hair for lice, they'd cut the beard too. You'd think. Anyway, they don't do it well. The hair is ragged. The back of his neck is nicked. That's hardly the worst. He looks 10 years older, 20. He's bent like an old man. His eyes are pouched. Small purple veins have burst in his cheeks. There's a scar. No, a wound. It isn't yet healed. The color of tulips near the stem end, down the left side of his face where the flesh split recently. The body is so easily damaged, so easily disposed of. Water and chemicals is all it is. Hardly more to it than a jellyfish, drying on sand. He finds it painful to move his hands, painful to move. He doesn't know what he's accused of, a problem. There must be something, some accusation. Otherwise, why are they keeping him? Why isn't he already dead? He must know something they want to know. I can't imagine. I can't imagine he hasn't already said whatever it is. I would. He is surrounded by a smell, his own, the smell of a cooped-up animal in a dirty cage. I imagine him resting, because I can't bear to imagine him at any other time, just as I can't imagine anything below his collar, above his cuffs. I don't want to think about what they've done to his body. Does he have shoes? No. And the floor is cold and wet. Does he know I'm here? Alive? That I'm thinking about him? I have to believe so. In reduced circumstances, you have to believe all kinds of things. I believe in thought transference now. Vibrations in the ether, that sort of junk. I never used to. I also believe that they didn't catch him or catch up with him after all, that he made it, reached the bank, swam the river, crossed the border, dragged himself up on the far shore, an island, teeth chattering, found his way to a nearby farmhouse, was allowed in, with suspicion at first, but then when they understood who he was, they were friendly. Not the sort who would turn him in. Perhaps they were Quakers. They will smuggle him inland. From house to house, the woman made him some hot coffee and gave him a set of her husband's clothes. I picture the clothes. It comforts me to dress him warmly. He made contact with the others. There must be a resistance, a government in exile. Someone must be out there taking care of things. I believe in the resistance as I believe there can be no light without shadow, or rather, no shadow unless there is also light. There must be a resistance, or where do all the criminals come from on the television? Any day now, there may be a message from him. It will come in the most unexpected way from the least likely person, someone I never would have suspected. Under my plate? On the dinner tray? Slipped into my hand as I reached the tokens across the counter in all flesh? The message will say that I must have patience. Sooner or later, he will get me out. We will find her, wherever they've put her. She'll remember us, and we will be, all three of us, together. Meanwhile, I must endure. Keep myself safe for later. What has happened to me, what's happening to me now, won't make any difference to him. He loves me anyway. He knows it isn't my fault. The message will say that also. It's this message, which may never arrive, that keeps me alive. I believe in the message. The things I believe can't all be true, though one of them must be. But I believe in all of them, all three versions of Luke, at one and the same time. This contradictory way of believing seems to me, right now, the only way I can believe anything. Whatever the truth is, I will be ready for it. This also is a belief of mine. This also may be untrue. One of the gravestones in the cemetery near the earliest church has an anchor on it and an hourglass, and the words, "In hope." In hope. Why did they put that above a dead person? Was it the corpse hoping, or those still alive? Does Luke hope? 8. Birthday. Chapter 19. I'm dreaming that I am awake. I dream that I get out of bed and walk across the room, not this room, and go out the door, not this door. I'm at home, one of my homes, and she's running to meet me in her small green nightgown with a sunflower on the front, her feet bare, and I pick her up and feel her arms and legs go around me, and I begin to cry, because I know then that I'm not awake. I'm back in this bed, trying to wake up, and I wake up and sit on the edge of the bed, and my mother comes in with a tray and asks me if I'm feeling better. When I was sick as a child, she had to stay home from work. But I'm not awake this time either. After these dreams, I do awake, and I know I'm really awake because there is the wreath on the ceiling and my curtains hanging like drowned white hair. I feel drugged. I consider this. Maybe they're drugging me. Maybe the life I think I'm living is a paranoid delusion. Not a hope. I know where I am and who and what day it is. These are the tests, and I am sane. Sanity is a valuable possession. I hoard it the way people once hoarded money. I save it so I will have enough when the time comes. Grayness comes through the curtains. Hazy, bright. Not much sun today. I get out of bed, go to the window, kneel on the window seat, the hard little cushion, faith, and look out. There is nothing to be seen. I wonder what has become of the other two cushions. There must have been three once. Hope and charity. Where have they been stowed? Serena Joy has tidy habits. She wouldn't throw away anything not quite worn out. One for Rita, one for Cora. The bell goes. I'm up before it, ahead of time. I dress, not looking down. I sit in the chair and think about the word chair. It can also mean the leader of a meeting. It can also mean a mode of execution. It is the first syllable in charity. It is the French word for flesh. None of these facts has any connection with the others. These are the kinds of litanies I use to compose myself. In front of me is a tray, and on the tray are a glass of apple juice, a vitamin pill, a spoon, a plate with three slices of brown toast on it, a small dish containing honey and another plate with an egg cup on it, the kind that looks like a woman's torso and a skirt. Under the skirt is the second egg being kept warm. The egg cup is white china with a blue stripe. The first egg is white. I move the egg cup a little, so now it's in the watery sunlight that comes through the window and falls, brightening, waning, brightening again on the tray. The shell of the egg is smooth but also grained. Small pebbles of calcium are defined by the sunlight, like craters on the moon. It's a barren landscape, yet perfect. It's a sort of desert the saints went into, so their minds would not be distracted by profusion. I think that this is what God must look like. An egg. The life of the moon may not be on the surface, but inside. The egg is glowing now, as if it had an energy of its own. To look at the egg gives me intense pleasure. The sun goes and the egg fades. I pick the egg out of the cup and finger it for a moment. It's warm. Women used to carry such eggs between their breasts to incubate them. That would have felt good. The minimalist life. Pleasure is an egg. Blessings that can be counted on the fingers of one hand. But possibly this is how I am expected to react. If I have an egg, what more can I want? In reduced circumstances, the desire to live attaches itself to strange objects. I would like a pet, a bird, say, or a cat, a familiar, anything at all familiar. A rat would do in a pinch, but there's no chance of that. This house is too clean. I slice the top off the egg with a spoon and eat the contents. While I'm eating the second egg, I hear the siren at a great distance at first, winding its way towards me among the large houses and clipped lawns, a thin sound like the hum of an insect, then nearing, opening out, like a flower of sound opening into a trumpet. A proclamation. This siren. I put down my spoon. My heart speeds up. I go to the window again. Will it be blue and not for me? But I see it turn the corner, come along the street, stop in front of the house, still blaring, and it's red. Joy to the world. Rare enough these days. I leave the second egg half-eaten, hurry to the closet for my cloak, and already I can hear feet on the stairs and the voices calling. Hurry, says Cora. Won't wait all day. And she helps me on with the cloak. She's actually smiling. I almost run down the hall. The stairs are like skiing. The front door is wide. Today I can go through it, and the guardian stands there saluting. It started to rain, a drizzle, and the gravid smell of earth and grass fills the air. The red birthmobile is parked in the driveway. Its back door is open and I clamber in. The carpet on the floor is red. Red curtains are drawn over the windows. There are three women in here already, sitting on the benches that run the length of the van on either side. The guardian closes and locks the double doors and climbs into the front beside the driver. Through the glassed-over wire grille, we can see the backs of their heads. We start with a lurch, while overhead the siren screams, "Make way! Make way!" "Who is it?" I say to the woman next to me, into her ear, or where her ear must be under the white headdress. I almost have to shout, the noise is so loud. "Of Warren," she shouts back. Impulsively, she grabs my hand, squeezes it, as we lurch around the corner. She turns to me, and I see her face. There are tears running down her cheeks. But tears of what? Envy? Disappointment? But no, she's laughing. She throws her arms around me. I've never seen her before. She hugs me. She has large breasts under the red habit. She wipes her sleeve across her face. On this day, we can do anything we want. I revise that. Within limits. Across from us on the other bench, one woman is praying, eyes closed, hands up to her mouth. Or she may not be praying. She may be biting her thumbnails. Possibly she's trying to keep calm. The third woman is calm already. She sits with her arms folded, smiling a little. The siren goes on and on. That used to be the sound of death, for ambulances or fires. Possibly it will be the sound of death today also. We will soon know. What will Of Warren give birth to? A baby, as we all hope? Or something else? An unbaby with a pinhead or snout like a dog's, or two bodies, or a hole in its heart, or no arms, or webbed hands and feet. There's no telling. They could tell once with machines, but that is now outlawed. What would be the point of knowing anyway? You can't have them taken out. Whatever it is must be carried to term. The chances are 1 in 4. We learned that at the center. The air got too full once of chemicals, rays, radiation. The water swarmed with toxic molecules. All of that takes years to clean up, and meanwhile they creep into your body, camp out in your fatty cells. Who knows? Your very flesh may be polluted, dirty as an oily beach. Sure death to shorebirds and unborn babies. Maybe a vulture would die of eating you. Maybe you light up in the dark like an old-fashioned watch, death watch. That's a kind of beetle. It buries carrion. I can't think of myself, my body, sometimes, without seeing the skeleton. How I must appear to an electron. A cradle of life made of bones, and within, hazards, warped proteins, bad crystals, jagged as glass. Women took medicines, pills. Men sprayed trees, cows ate grass, all that souped-up piss flowed into the rivers. Not to mention the exploding atomic power plants along the San Andreas Fault. Nobody's fault. During the earthquakes and the mutant strain of syphilis, no mold could touch. Some did it themselves, had themselves tied shut with catgut or scarred with chemicals. "How could they?" said Aunt Lydia. "Oh, how could they have done such a thing? Jezebels, scorning God's gifts," wringing her hands. "It's a risk you're taking," said Aunt Lydia. "But you are the shock troops. You will march out in advance into dangerous territory. The greater the risk, the greater the glory." She clasped her hands, radiant with our phony courage. We looked down at the tops of our desks. To go through all that and give birth to a shredder, it wasn't a fine thought. We didn't know exactly what would happen to the babies that didn't get passed, that were declared unbabies. But we knew they were put somewhere, quickly, away. "There was no one cause," says Aunt Lydia. She stands at the front of the room in her khaki dress, a pointer in her hand. Pulled down in front of the blackboard, where once there would have been a map, is a graph, showing the birth rate per thousand, for years and years, a slippery slope, down past the zero line of replacement, and down, and down. Of course, some women believed there would be no future. They thought the world would explode. That was the excuse they used, says Aunt Lydia. They said there was no sense in breeding. Aunt Lydia's nostrils narrow. Such wickedness. They were lazy women, she says. They were sluts. On the top of my desk, there are initials carved into the wood and dates. The initials are sometimes in two sets, joined by the word loves. J.H. Loves B.P., 1954. O.R. Loves L.T. These seem to me like the inscriptions I used to read about, carved on the stone walls of caves, or drawn with a mixture of soot and animal fat. They seem to me incredibly ancient. The desktop is of blonde wood. It slants down, and there is an armrest on the right side to lean on when you are writing on paper with a pen. Inside the desk you could keep things, books, notebooks. These habits of former times appear to me now lavish, decadent almost, immoral, like the orgies of barbarian regimes. M. Loves G., 1972. This carving, done with a pencil dug many times into the worn varnish of the desk, has the pathos of all vanished civilizations. It's like a handprint on stone. Whoever made that was once alive. There are no dates after the mid-80s. This must have been one of the schools that was closed down then for lack of children. They made mistakes, says Aunt Lydia. We don't intend to repeat them. Her voice is pious, condescending, the voice of those whose duty it is to tell us unpleasant things for our own good. I would like to strangle her. I shove this thought away almost as soon as I think it. A thing is valued, she says, only if it is rare and hard to get. We want you to be valued, girls. She is rich in pauses, which she savors in her mouth. Think of yourselves as pearls. We, sitting in our rows, eyes down, we make her salivate morally. We are hers to define. We must suffer her adjectives. I think about pearls. Pearls are congealed oyster spit. This is what I will tell Moira later, if I can. All of us here will lick you into shape, says Aunt Lydia, with satisfied good cheer. The van stops. The back doors are opened. The guardian herds us out. At the front door stands another guardian, with one of those snubby machine guns slung over his shoulder. We file towards the front door, in the drizzle, the guardians saluting. The big Emerge van, the one with the machines and the mobile doctors, is parked farther along the circular drive. I see one of the doctors looking out of the window of the van. I wonder what they do in there, waiting. Play cards, most likely, or read. Some masculine pursuit. Most of the time they aren't needed at all. They're only allowed in if it can't be helped. It used to be different. They used to be in charge. A shame it was, said Aunt Lydia. Shameful. What she'd just showed us was a film made in an olden days hospital. A pregnant woman, wired up to a machine, electrodes coming out of her every which way so that she looked like a broken robot, an intravenous drip feeding into her arm. Some man with a searchlight looking up between her legs where she's been shaved. A mere beardless girl, trayful of bright, sterilized knives, everyone with masks on. A cooperative patient. Once they drugged women, induced labor, cut them open, sewed them up, no more. No anesthetics, even. Aunt Elizabeth said it was better for the baby, but also, "I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children." At lunch we got that. Brown bread and lettuce sandwiches. As I'm going up the steps, wide steps with a stone urn on either side, of Warren's commander must be higher status than ours, I hear another siren. It's the blue birthmobile for wives. That will be Serena Joy, arriving in state. No benches for them, they get real seats, upholstery. They face front and are not curtained off. They know where they're going. Probably Serena Joy has been here before to this house for tea. Probably of Warren, formerly that whiny bitch Janine, was paraded out in front of her, her and the other wives, so they could see her belly, feel it, perhaps, and congratulate the wife. A strong girl, good muscles. No Agent Orange in her family, we checked the records, you can never be too careful. And perhaps one of the kinder ones. Would you like a cookie, dear? Oh no, you'll spoil her, too much sugar is bad for them. Surely one won't hurt, just this once, Mildred. And sucky Janine. Oh yes, can I, ma'am, please? So well behaved. Not surly like some of them. Do their job and that's that. More like a daughter to you, as you might say, one of the family. Comfortable, matronly chuckles. That's all, dear. You can go back to your room. And after she's gone, little whores, all of them, but still, you can't be choosy. You take what they hand out, right, girls? That from the commander's wife. Mine. Oh, but you've been so lucky. Some of them, why, they aren't even clean. And won't give you a smile, mope in their rooms, don't wash their hair. The smell. I have to get the Marthas to do it. Almost have to hold her down in the bathtub. You practically have to bribe her to get her to take a bath, even. You have to threaten her. I had to take stern measures with mine, and now she doesn't eat her dinner properly. And as for the other thing, not a nibble, and we've been so regular. But yours, oh, she's a credit to you. And any day now, oh, you must be so excited. She's big as a house. I bet you can hardly wait. More tea? Modestly changing the subject. I know the sort of thing that goes on. And Janine, up in her room, what does she do? Sits with a taste of sugar still in her mouth, licking her lips. Stares out the window. Breathes in and out. Caresses her swollen breasts. Thinks of nothing. Chapter 20. The central staircase is wider than ours, with a curved banister on either side. From above, I can hear the chanting of the women who are already there. We go up the stairs, single file, being careful not to step on the trailing hems of each other's dresses. To the left, the double doors to the dining room are folded back, and inside, I can see the long table, covered with a white cloth and spread with a buffet. Ham, cheese, oranges, they have oranges, and fresh-baked breads and cakes. As for us, we'll get milk and sandwiches on a tray later, but they have a coffee urn and bottles of wine, for why shouldn't the wives get a little drunk on such a triumphant day? First, they'll wait for the results, then they'll pig out. They're gathered in the sitting room on the other side of the stairway now, cheering on this commander's wife, the wife of Warren. A small, thin woman, she lies on the floor in a white cotton nightgown, her graying hair spreading like mildew over the rug. They massage her tiny belly, just as if she's really about to give birth herself. The commander, of course, is nowhere in sight. He's gone wherever men go on such occasions, some hideout. Probably he's figuring out when his promotion is likely to be announced, if all goes well. He's sure to get one now. Of Warren is in the master bedroom, a good name for it, where this commander and his wife nightly bed down. She's sitting on their king-size bed, propped with pillows. Janine, inflated but reduced, shorn of her former name. She's wearing a white cotton shift, which is hiked up over her thighs. Her long, broom-colored hair is pulled back and tied behind her head to keep it out of the way. Her eyes are squeezed closed, and this way I can almost like her. After all, she's one of us. What did she ever want but to lead her life as agreeably as possible? What else did any of us want? It's the possible that's the catch. She's not doing badly, under the circumstances. Two women I don't know stand on either side of her, gripping her hands, or she theirs. A third lifts the nightgown, pours baby oil onto her mound of stomach, rubs downward. At her feet stands Aunt Elizabeth in her khaki dress with the military breast pockets. She was the one who taught Guy Ned. All I can see of her is the side of her head, her profile, but I know it's her, that jutting nose and handsome chin, severe. At her side stands the birthing stool, with its double seat, the back one raised like a throne behind the other. They won't put Janine on it before it's time. The blankets stand ready, the small tub for bathing, the bowl of ice for Janine to suck. The rest of the women sit cross-legged on the rug. There's a crowd of them. Everyone in this district is supposed to be here. There must be 25, 30. Not every commander has a handmaid. Some of their wives have children. From each, says the slogan, according to her ability. To each, according to his needs. We recited that 3 times after dessert. It was from the Bible, or so they said. St. Paul again, in Acts. You are a transitional generation, said Aunt Lydia. It is the hardest for you. We know the sacrifices you are being expected to make. It is hard when men revile you. For the ones who come after you, it will be easier. They will accept their duties with willing hearts. She did not say, because they will have no memories of any other way. She said, because they won't want things they can't have. Once a week, we had movies, after lunch and before our nap. We sat on the floor of the domestic science room, on our little gray mats, and waited while Aunt Helena and Aunt Lydia struggled with the projection equipment. If we were lucky, they wouldn't get the film threaded upside down. What it reminded me of was geography classes at my own high school thousands of years before, where they showed movies of the rest of the world. Women in long skirts or cheap printed cotton dresses, carrying bundles of sticks or baskets, or plastic buckets of water from some river or other, with babies slung on them in shawls or net slings, looking squint-eyed or afraid out of the screen at us, knowing something was being done to them by a machine with one glass eye but not knowing what. Those movies were comforting and faintly boring. They made me feel sleepy, even when men came onto the screen with naked muscles hacking away at hard dirt with primitive hoes and shovels, hauling rocks. I preferred movies with dancing in them, singing, ceremonial masks, carved artifacts for making music, feathers, brass buttons, conch shells, drums. I liked watching these people when they were happy, Not when they were miserable, starving, emaciated, straining themselves to death over some simple thing, the digging of a well, the irrigation of land, problems the civilized nations had long ago solved. I thought someone should just give them the technology and let them get on with it. Aunt Lydia didn't show these kinds of movies. Sometimes the movie she showed would be an old porno film from the 70s or 80s. Women kneeling, sucking penises or guns. Women tied up or chained or with dog collars around their necks. Women hanging from trees or upside down, naked, with their legs held apart. Women being raped, beaten up, killed. Once we had to watch a woman being slowly cut into pieces, her fingers and breasts snipped off with garden shears, her stomach slit open, and her intestines pulled out. "Consider the alternatives," said Aunt Lydia. "You see what things used to be like? That was what they thought of women then." Her voice trembled with indignation. Moira said later that it wasn't real. It was done with models, but it was hard to tell. Sometimes, though, the movie would be what Aunt Lydia called an unwoman documentary. "Imagine," said Aunt Lydia, "wasting their time like that when they should have been doing something useful." Back then, the unwomen were always wasting time. They were encouraged to do it. The government gave them money to do that very thing. "Mind you, some of their ideas were sound enough," she went on, with the smug authority in her voice of one who is in a position to judge. "We would have to condone some of their ideas even today." "Only some, mind you," she said coyly, raising her index finger, waggling it at us. "But they were godless, and that can make all the difference, don't you agree?" I sit on my mat, hands folded, and Aunt Lydia steps to the side, away from the screen, and the lights go out, and I wonder whether I can, in the dark, lean far over to the right without being seen and whisper to the woman next to me. What will I whisper? I will say, "Have you seen Moira?" Because nobody has. She wasn't at breakfast. But the room, although dim, isn't dark enough, so I switch my mind into the holding pattern that passes for attention. They don't play the soundtrack on movies like these, though they do on the porno films. They want us to hear the screams and grunts and shrieks of what is supposed to be either extreme pain or extreme pleasure or both at once, but they don't want us to hear what the unwomen are saying. First come the title and some names, blacked out on the film with a crayon so we can't read them, and then I see my mother. My young mother, younger than I remember her, as young as she must have been once before I was born. She's wearing the kind of outfit Aunt Lydia told us was typical of unwomen in those days. Overall jeans with a green and mauve plaid shirt underneath and sneakers on her feet. The sort of thing Moira once wore. The sort of thing I can remember wearing long ago myself. Her hair is tucked into a mauve kerchief tied behind her head. Her face is very young, very serious, even pretty. I've forgotten my mother was once as pretty and as earnest as that. She's in a group of other women, dressed in the same fashion. She's holding a stick. No, it's part of a banner, the handle. The camera pans up and we see the writing in paint on what must have been a bedsheet. "Take back the night." This hasn't been blacked out, even though we aren't supposed to be reading. The women around me breathe in. There's a stirring in the room like wind over grass. Is this an oversight? Have we gotten away with something? Or is this a thing we're intended to see, to remind us of the old days of no safety? Behind this sign, there are other signs, and the camera notices them briefly. "Freedom to choose. Every baby a wanted baby. Recapture our bodies. Do you believe a woman's place is on the kitchen table?" Under the last sign, there's a line drawing of a woman's body lying on a table, blood dripping out of it. Now my mother is moving forward, She's smiling, laughing. They all move forward, and now they're raising their fists in the air. The camera moves to the sky, where hundreds of balloons rise, trailing their strings, red balloons with a circle painted on them, a circle with a stem like the stem of an apple, the stem of a cross. Back on the earth, my mother is part of the crowd now, and I can't see her anymore. I had you when I was 37, my mother said. It was a risk. You could have been deformed or something. You were a wanted child, all right, and I did get shit from some quarters. My oldest buddy, Trisha, accused me of being a pronatalist, the bitch. Jealousy, I put that down too. Some of the others were okay, though. But when I was 6 months pregnant, a lot of them started sending me these articles about how the birth defect rate went zooming up after 35. Yeah, just what I needed. And stuff about how hard it was to be a single parent. Fuck that shit, I told them. I've started this, and I'm gonna finish it. At the hospital, they wrote down aged primipara on the chart. I caught them in the act. That's what they call you when it's your first baby over 30. Over 30, for God's sake. Garbage, I told them. Biologically, I'm 22. I could run rings around you any day. I could have triplets and walk out of here while you were still trying to get up off the bed. When she said that, she jut out her chin. I remember her like that, her chin jutted out, a drink in front of her on the kitchen table. Not young and earnest and pretty the way she was in the movie, but wiry, spunky. The kind of old woman who won't let anyone butt in front of her in a supermarket line. She liked to come over to my house and have a drink while Luke and I were fixing dinner and tell us what was wrong with her life, which always turned into what was wrong with ours. Her hair was gray by that time, of course. She wouldn't dye it. Why pretend, she'd say. Anyway, what do I need it for? I don't want a man around. What use are they except for 10 seconds worth of half babies? A man is just a woman's strategy for making other women. Not that your father wasn't a nice guy and all, but he wasn't up to fatherhood. Not that I expected it of him. Just do the job, then you can bugger off, I said. I make a decent salary. I can afford daycare. So he went to the coast and sent Christmas cards. He had beautiful blue eyes, though. But there's something missing in them, even the nice ones. It's like they're permanently absent-minded, like they can't quite remember who they are. They look at the sky too much. They lose touch with their feet. They aren't a patch on a woman, except they're better at fixing cars and playing football. Just what we need for the improvement of the human race, right? That was the way she talked, even in front of Luke. He didn't mind. He teased her by pretending to be macho. He'd tell her women were incapable of abstract thought, and she'd have another drink and grin at him. Chauvinist pig, she'd say. Isn't she quaint, Luke would say to me, and my mother would look sly, furtive, almost. I'm entitled, she'd say. I'm old enough, I've paid my dues, it's time for me to be quaint. You're still wet behind the ears. Piglet, I should have said. As for you, she'd say to me, you're just a backlash, flash in the pan. History will absolve me. But she wouldn't say things like that until after the third drink. You young people don't appreciate things, she'd say. You don't know what we had to go through just to get you where you are. Look at him, slicing up the carrots. Don't you know how many women's lives, how many women's bodies the tanks had to roll over just to get that far? Cooking's my hobby, Luke would say. I enjoy it. Hobby schmobby, my mother would say. You don't have to make excuses to me. Once upon a time, you wouldn't have been allowed to have such a hobby. They'd have called you queer. Now, mother, I would say, let's not get into an argument about nothing. Nothing, she'd say bitterly. You call it nothing. You don't understand, do you? You don't understand at all what I'm talking about. Sometimes she would cry. I was so lonely, she'd say. You have no idea how lonely I was. And I had friends. I was a lucky one. But I was lonely anyway. I admired my mother in some ways, although things between us were never easy. She expected too much from me, I felt. She expected me to vindicate her life for her and the choices she'd made. I didn't want to live my life on her terms. I didn't want to be the model offspring, the incarnation of her ideas. We used to fight about that. "I am not your justification for existence," I said to her once. I want her back. I want everything back, the way it was. But there is no point to it, this wanting.